Well, hello. My name is Amit Dungrani, and I'm excited to be your host for our weekly Global Awakening call today. Today, our special guest speaker is Elizabeth Sartouris. She is someone that really embodies our theme today of ecosophy and nature's guide to a better world. We have the pleasure of a remarkable moderator, Arya Cooper-Smith, with us today. So, Arya, thank you for joining us, and any thoughts about today's conversation?
Well, thank you, Amit, and I'd actually like to get right into saying a few words of introduction about Elizabeth. As you've posted, Amit, she's an internationally known evolutionary biologist and futurist and author and consultant to all kinds of organizations, government, business, using the wisdom or embodying the wisdom of nature and how we design our social structures. She's written a number of books, including A Walk Through Time, From Stardust to Us, another one called Biology Revisioned, a more recent one called Earth Dance, Living Systems in Evolution, and her current Kindle book, Gaia's Dance, The Story of the Earth and Us. And that most recent book is really, it's taking all of the science that she has brought together in her worldview and telling it like a very simple story, like a child's story. I have to confess that my response to going through Elizabeth's books and articles has been kind of mixed, because on the one hand, the worldview and the challenge to us is so compelling, and on the other hand, there's so much scholarship and science in there that I really have to stretch my brain in order to get through it. So I really love the idea of a conversation and a story as a way for us to be introduced to this. Elizabeth is a fellow of the World Business Academy. She's an advisor to ethicalmarkets.com and the Masters in Business program at Schumacher College. She's affiliated with the Bainbridge Graduate Institute MBA program. She's a UN consultant on indigenous peoples. And she's lived extensively in Greece, in the Peruvian Andes. And she now lives in Mallorca, Spain. And in the first week in April, she's going to be in the Bay Area visiting her daughter, who I believe is a physician at Highland Hospital. So, Elizabeth, I want to say thank you so much for taking the time and joining us this morning and sharing some of the wisdom of nature that you have been uncovering with us.
Thanks, Arye. It's lovely to be with you.
Okay, so, you know, in terms of our conversation for the next 35, 40 minutes or so, I'm thinking of this in three parts. You talk so much about the story of the evolution of all life and life forms on this planet. And so I would like to start initially to ask you to share with us a little bit about your own story of your own personal evolution to the calling that you've had and the work that you're doing now. And in the second part, I want to ask you to share with us your view of the story of our living planet and life on this planet. And then the third part, I want to ask you about what are the practical implications for us here on this call for how we might think about our lives and the kinds of choices and decisions we might make. So, you know, starting with my curiosity about some of your personal story, my wife and I had some friends over to lunch yesterday, and they came from different parts of the world and different places, and we were reflecting on, you know, the the sort of amazingly complex sequence of events that had to happen in order for us to be sitting having lunch at the same place and the same time. And one of our friends remarked that the way he experiences his life is it's like being a passenger in a moving vehicle, and when he looks out the front window, it's foggy, and he can't really see where the road is going. And when he looks out the back window, it's really clear. It becomes clear to him when he looks back the path that his life has taken. So I want to ask you if you would share with us on your journey, on your evolutionary journey, starting with your early years, your childhood, your adolescence, your young adulthood, some of what stands out for you as key points along the way that set you on the journey you've been on.
I'd be happy to, Arye, but let me just say first that because I am a planet person, I am aware that here I am on the island of Mallorca in the Mediterranean Sea, the European Mediterranean, and Mediterra means mid-earth, so I've always thought of it as the mid-earth sea, having lived in both Greece and Spain on it for quite a lot of time. And then you are all the way over on the west coast of North America in California, and our technician Amit is on the east coast, on the Atlantic coast. So we're having a pretty planetary conversation here, and I hope we've got people in lots of other wonderful spots in the world. And, of course, I'm on my way shortly to Hawaii to live, which is in the middle of the biggest pond of all. So I just wanted to call attention to that.
That's
and you're talking about – pardon? Yeah, you talked about your visitor who said it was foggy up front but clear behind, and that reminds me of a wonderful story I heard while living in Greece about Socrates, that just before he died, one of his students said to him, "Master, how did you see the path ahead so clearly that you could follow it so truly?" And Socrates responded, "I never saw the path ahead. However, I could always tell, I had always a gut feeling when I was off my path, and therefore I could stay on it." And I thought that was one of the most wonderful pieces of advice I ever heard in my life, because at the time I heard it, I was very envious of people who had spirit guides and who saw their future ahead and knew exactly what to do in their lives. And here we are on this roller coaster ride in our world now, and none of us can see the path ahead clearly. So it does pay to look back, and that is why I became a deep pastist in order to be a good futurist. Knowing the long evolutionary trajectory of our coming into this world as humans helps us to figure out what we can do, what can we learn from 4 billion years of past experience of the Earth in trying out living systems and all that. So I say I became a deep pastist in order to be a good futurist. Mm. Now, as to your question, as a child, I was already asking the big questions that I didn't know were the great philosophical questions of all time. Who are we? Where did we come from? Where are we headed? And by the time I was about 8 or 9 years old, I was very interested in biology. I had the good fortune to grow up in the Hudson Valley. I was actually born in Athens, New York, and then later became a Greek citizen. I was free to explore nature on my own, no grown-ups watching. I wrote a poem called No Grown-Ups Watching for kids on Earth Day, that I was an Earth kid. And I got to explore, to climb high trees, to cross fences that said no trespassing, to walk on thin ice with no grown-ups watching. And I noticed that my own grandchildren didn't have that freedom in nature, that they were always watched, and it drove me a little nuts at times. It's not the same world. We can't trust our children to nature in the way my parents could when I was a child. Anyway, I wanted to study science. My parents, however, said science was a boy's subject, And I finished high school at 16, and they said no art school, you know, art and music and culture and things like that. And I insisted on going to a university and got myself a 4-year room, board, and tuition scholarship so that they had to let me go to a university. And I did study art because of my parents still being in control to some degree. And only after I got a degree in art did I go back to graduate school and become a scientist, as I always had wanted to. And my art background serves me well now. I make beautiful slides to go with my lectures and, you know, have an artistic flair about what I do. So I did eventually become a scientist. I also got eventually interested in spirituality when I started to question whether science was the only possible worldview. And I was very interested in what was going on in the world because I lived through World War II as a child. I was outraged by the injustices of it and swore that that would never happen again and I would do what I could to prevent it. And so I got into how did economics determine politics and all of those questions. So my life has been about braiding those three things together, the interest in science, in spirituality, and in economics and politics. And that helped me to develop a really big picture worldview, a coherent worldview, because I always felt that whatever I learned in any of those three areas had to be fit into a consistent worldview so that the things didn't contradict each other. When I did have contradictions, I learned to hold them and let them work themselves through and to see from higher perspectives where you can see the relationship between things that are apparently contradictory. So that's kind of my trajectory in a nutshell.
Thank you. Wow, so much there. You know, I'm curious on sort of as I think about your life trajectory, and, you know, you brought up all the different spots in the planet where we are right now talking to each other. I'm struck with how many different places on the planet you've been and lived, in the Peruvian Andes, in Greece, and where you are now in Mallorca.
Canada.
Could you say a little bit about that, about how you got from, you know, graduate school in the U.S. to find yourself in all these different places around the world?
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to remember. Somewhere in the 70s, I got felt that the worldview taught to me by science was a suit that was too tight, and I had to break through it. And I had the wonderful good fortune of meeting Henry Miller, the writer, not to be confused with Arthur Miller, the one that Marilyn Monroe married, the playwright. But Henry Miller was a rule breaker, a maverick who had lived in Paris and was an artist and a writer and broke all the rules about talking about sex in books. And, you know, we all read his smuggled books when we were young because they weren't even out there available to society at large. And Henry gave me this taste for Greece because he had written this wonderful book called The Colossus of Marousi. And he and I had a lot of time to have long, wonderful conversations while the person who had brought me to Henry's was out researching in a library. And that was a very influential time in my life. It was a very short period, but I decided I too wanted to go to Greece and that I would just study ancient healing centers and interesting things that were far from science. And so I actually went to Greece and said, I'm going to write novels to explain the human condition to myself because science isn't answering my big questions. And that's how I got to Greece. And I got a real taste for moving around the world and later had the opportunity. I'd come back to the States. And by the way, during the 60s, I'd been up in Canada and had study groups of people from all over the world and things like that going to try to figure out, again, what was the human condition. So I had already had a little background in foreign travel. And then while I was in Washington, I got this spirit call to go to Peru and decided to follow it. And ever since then, I've gotten occasionally these very clear calls that just come out of the blue to me telling me where to go. And if I jump on it and, you know, be impulsive and go, things work out, and sometimes I find out later why I was drawn to that place. So, yeah, I have moved around, and it's usually been in that kind of impulsive way, and I'm a great freedom kind of person who tries to keep myself light, and even though I raised two children and, you know, stayed put for their infancy and childhoods, enough to get them into adulthood, I love traveling around the planet, and now I'm actually in my 80th year and bopping off to Hawaii on one of those spirit calls, and already involved in a massive project for making Hawaii economically resilient and in the spirit of aloha and things like that.
Wow. Talk about rule breakers. I wonder who's bigger rule breaker, Henry Miller or you?
Well, you know, one of the things that's always been fascinating to me is to get absolutely opposite perspectives on the same thing. You know, I used to sit around with MIT professors discussing our society in the mornings, and then at night work with black inmates in the prison to see what their perspective on our society was, or go to Costa Rica and learn to dance reggae in the jungle one day and then have cocktails in the presidential palace the next day. And so I somehow my life worked out to get these amazing experiences from very opposite perspectives. And that, I think, helped me to really expand my worldview and to be more tolerant of other people's worldviews, to recognize eventually that we do live by our stories and that we create our stories through our experience. I used to give workshops where I asked people basic questions like what they thought about religion and humanity and stuff at the age of 10 and then at the age of 20 and then at the age of 30, depending on what age group it was, give them about 3 levels in their lives to see how their stories changed. And then to look into why did they change? What makes you change your story? And, you know, often as not, it's crises that make for the big changes in people's worldview stories. So that's very interesting to me, too, because here we are, humanity as a whole now, having created this perfect storm of crises, and we're having to change our story. We've basically been living by the Darwinian story of fierce competition, that people are self-interested only, and capitalism has been based on this story, this Darwinian story. And when I look back to evolution, I found that that was not all of it, that there was another part to the story, that the species are feisty and competitive and very creative in their youth, and then it comes to the point where it gets too expensive to keep bumping off all your competitors, and it actually becomes less costly to start negotiating with each other and forming cooperative unions that help you to get to a cooperative, mature phase in life. So I now see humanity right at that tipping point where we're in our adolescence, we've lived by this hero's journey story, it's globalized us, and now we get to do the really interesting stuff of weaving ourselves together in cooperative ways, in the gifting society way that Nipun has so brilliantly pioneered for us.
Mm. Well, okay, so, you know, you're leading us right into the next part of our conversation. And, you know, when you talk about the human species having sort of reached the point of the destructiveness of our adolescence that is resulting in the multiple crises the world is in now, and then the opportunity for us to reach into our maturity, I know that in various writings that you've done, you talk about how this has not only been the case with us, but it's been kind of built into the evolutionary process of life itself. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. You know, half of evolution was all about bacteria. They were the only life form of the Earth. And I was very influenced by Jim Lovelock's books on Gaia, the living Earth concept, and his partner in that project, Lynn Margulis, who really looked into the microbiology of the first half of evolution. And to make a very long story short, 2 billion years of it, microbes, bacteria, did a huge amount of creative, inventive stuff over that long period of time that actually rearranged the Earth's crust and created its atmosphere as we know it, and changed the composition of the chemical composition of the seas, and just they were so prolific, and they also, as the only other life form on the planet other than ourselves, created global crises. They created the global crisis of hunger, for example, by using up all the free sugars and acids that had formed as food for bacteria on the surface of the Earth. And then in solving the food crisis by inventing photosynthesis, which is a way of making food out of what was still left, namely sunlight and water and the minerals of the Earth's crust, in creating food synthetically that way by photosynthesis, they caused a global pollution problem because their waste gas was oxygen, which, you know, we're always worried about how we need to take antioxidants and stuff because oxygen is a very corrosive gas and it was killing off a lot of the bacteria. Anyway, as I said, I wanted to make that long story short too. And eventually what happened when the competition got too costly was those ancient bacteria formed the only other kind of cell ever to evolve on this planet, and that is the nucleated cells that we ourselves are made of. We have 100 trillion of them in each of our bodies, and this amazing complexity such that each of them, which was originally way back in evolution a bacterial cooperative where different bacteria got together and did a division of labor and worked out a way to give up some of each of their DNA to the central library we call the nucleus. So that our cells are actually ancient bacterial cooperatives. And some of the little bacteria are still identifiable in our cells, such as the mitochondria, which make all our energy. And they have their own DNA outside the nucleus, which is, you know, relatively recent kinds of discoveries in the past decades of science. So anyway, Lynn Margulis, who had worked with Jim Lovelock, put together that whole story of the symbiosis of ancient bacteria informing the cells we're made of. Now, once that cooperation happened, these cells were new on the planet, so they had to go through their own youth. And it took another billion years before they went to the next stage of evolution, forming their cooperatives as multi-celled creatures. Right? That's what we are. So these were the two biggest steps in biological evolution, the formation of the nucleated cell by the ancient bacteria and the formation of the multicelled creatures by those nucleated cells, those protists, as they're called, and that literally means in Greek first builders, because they later build the multicelled creatures. So again, it was probably crises that drove, you know, this cooperation as multicelled creatures. Now, humans are multicelled creatures, so I'll skip over all the part of evolution biology that you all know, that you were taught in school, which was about things forming in the sea and then coming out onto land and the flowers and the trees and the mammals and the birds and the fishes and all that. We know, we learned that part in school. So here we are, multicelled creatures, humans, and humans actually went through this same maturation cycle at the tribal level. And we're just learning this now. We're just digging up the first cities, which are the equivalent of the nucleated cells, because they look at any city from an airplane, you know, by day or night, and you see that there's a sort of nuclear center and then all these things going on around it, the transport systems, the energy, the banks, the you know, everything that goes on in a city. Each of your cells is as complex as a large human city. If you can grok that, multiplying it by 100 billion times. It's you know, it's almost unthinkable. But the fact is that our bodies are actually about halfway in size between the microcosm and the macrocosm, the whole universe and the tiniest Planck length tininess that physicists, you know, have dug down into. That is, you know, like billionths of inches. So anyway,
it is amazing.
Tribal people,
yeah,
these cities are just now being dug up in Central America, in South America, in the Amazon, in the Orkney Islands, Northern England, and Africa. All over, we're finding that tribes got together cooperatively, probably primarily for trade purposes, and built these first cities. And then exactly like the nucleated cells that the bacteria had built, they had to start over and go through their maturation. And the cities went into the process we call empire building. And we're now in the third phase of empire building. In the first phase, they were actually ruled by emperors, and they expanded. They were acquisitive, just like, you know, all the useful species are. And then the second phase was national empires, and now we're in the corporate empire phase, which has globalized us. So we have to do it once more. We have to, again, drop our creative hostilities and form the kind of cooperative that the whole earth is already. Humans have to create our cooperative within nature.
It is a mind-blowing vision, Elizabeth, to think of the level of complexity that you described in our trillions of cells, and how what we need to do on a macrocosm level is the same that's happened on a microcosm level. You know, I think this might be a good point for me to ask you, what is ecosophy, and how does that sort of pull together the way of understanding what you've been talking about?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think everybody's familiar with the terms ecology and economy. Both of those words come from the ancient Greek ekos, which means household, and was the word the ancient Greeks used for all levels of organization, from the family household to the social household to the cosmic household. And that when you put that household word together with either nomos or logos to make economy or ecology, the nomos is the rules of the household, and the logos is the organization, the logic, the organization of the household. Now, we humans made our economies superior to nature's ecologies. We saw ecology as, or ecosystems, as the a set of resources we usually call the environment. It's kind of an impersonal word I don't particularly like. An ecosystem is more inclusive. We're in it. So that ecosystem has become subservient to the human economy. So we devastated our ecosystems. We pillaged and plundered them in order to build a high-tech world in our youthful creative expansion. And what we have to do now is turn that around and make our economies subservient to the ecosystems, to the ecology. In other words, we have to learn how to live clean and green so that we don't destroy nature because we still depend on it for our lives. And that is what I call the ecos, the household, that is Sophos, or wise. The wise household is the one that neither separates ecology from economy nor makes the one subservient to the other. And so that is what I mean by ecosophy. It's a term that was coined by several other people. I can't think of his last name. The first person who used the word used it to get us to respect nature, you know, to understand the wisdom of nature and to be more respectful of it. And then there was a French philosopher also who used it in a somewhat different way. All of that is explained in my Ecosophy article, which is easy to click on and find online in Cosmos Magazine. So people can review that.
And that is on the Daily Good, that's been posted on Daily Good for those of you who linked into that. So, Elizabeth, I'm there's one thing that I've been wondering about, that so much of what you've done has been involved with consulting to organizations and consulting to business. So I'm curious, when you're consulting with business leaders who, presumably are driven as they must be by, the bottom line and increasing shareholder value and all of that good stuff, what kinds of conversations do you have with them?
Well, it's interesting because when you get business leadership in one-to-one conversations or in small groups or something like that, they really can hear what I'm trying to say. And for example, 2 years ago almost now, I was in Istanbul with a very high-level group of people from the boards and management of the biggest multinationals in the world, companies like Siemens and Shell Oil and BP and IKEA and Microsoft and, the really big ones all together in one place. And what I said to them basically was, thank you for being the heroes of globalizing our world. That was a necessary step for humanity. And now I'd like to invite you to become the heroes of the next phase where we level off and become sustainable. And then I apologized for my field of science not having given them a story for it, because they were following the Darwinian story and still in the youthful mode when we needed to grow up and mature. So then I gave them a kind of one-minute elevator pitch of what it meant for us to mature and cooperate in the world instead of exploiting to each other and creating these enormous wealth gaps. And you all know what the picture is nowadays. And they can hear you when you're up close and personal with them like that. But when they go back into their own environments, that new story isn't supported there. And that's the real hitch. I just today got an email from a young man who works for that foundation that I was with, and I was with him again this year in Oslo, or actually it's now last year. Last June was last year. And he said, finally, it is getting through, and the oil companies are recognizing that their time is up and that they're going to have to do something different. And I see this everywhere now, that 2015 is going to be this tipping point for us, that people just can't ignore what's going on anymore, and that these big companies have to recognize that either they change and go with the new flow and work on clean green energy, or they're going to be out of business. So I still have hope. But the important thing is ordinary people all over the world getting it, because we're in for a very, very devastating time, and we have to start working now to at least create the sustainable pockets that can survive the disasters coming.
It's fascinating for me, having in my career done a little bit of corporate consulting, to hear you say about how some of the leaders of the biggest corporations on a personal level will get it when you're talking with them, but then they go back into their ecosystem and get pulled back, but then maybe they start bumping into each other. And, this reminds me of your story of the caterpillar and the butterfly, where those little butterfly cells and the caterpillar start sort of finding each other. Could you just share that story with us and how that applies here?
Yes, exactly. It's not my story, first and foremost. It's the butterfly's own story. And secondly, I got it from a lady named Nori Huddle, who lives in Ecuador now, and who wrote a wonderful children's book called Butterfly, where she used this metaphor of metamorphosis for what's going on in our world. Now, the caterpillar is a wonderful metaphor for our current economic system because it eats up to 300 times its weight in a day as it munches its way destructively through its ecosystem and then is so bloated it hangs itself up to go to sleep and its skin hardens into a chrysalis. And then while it's kind of dormant, little imaginal cells, as the biologists actually call them, because the imago is the biological word for the forming butterfly, but it also is nicely about our imaginations of thinking up new worlds, new stories to live by. And these cells are like stem cells that have been folded into the inside skin of the caterpillar all its life and now come out and join up with each other and form the butterfly literally as the caterpillar dissolves from within. So here we are. We're seeing these oil companies imploding. We're seeing, you know, Monsanto being exposed for toxins that are making us sick. All of these things are happening now, the transparency coming in, and all of these things are going to dissolve on us because we're going to start living a different kind of future. And that is what I mean by the imaginal cells building the butterfly, as did Nori. And so it's a nice metaphor because it's simple, and the butterfly, of course, lives much more lightly on the earth than the caterpillar did. And so it's nice to see that story as our new story, that regardless of how destructive it gets inside that caterpillar, we are at the same time building the new world. You know, we used to think we were going to be like the phoenix rising from the ashes kind of story where everything gets completely destroyed and then somehow something new arises from it. But it's not like that at all. We have to do both at once. The old and the new worlds are living side by side or within each other right now. And if we want to have a better future, all we have to do is start to create it now by living it now. And if each one of us starts living the way we want people to live in the future, meaning treat each other the way you want people to treat each other in the future, and eat the kind of foods you think will be good for people in the future, and take care of your body in ways that you think will be good for people in the future, and if you then look around and see what did the previous generations do that you don't want to carry into the future, and don't carry it into the future. If one generation decides not to make war, war is gone. It's as simple as that. So at the same time that our bodies and our societies are so very complex, the essence of what's going on isn't complex at all. It is like the metamorphosis of the caterpillar into the butterfly. It's like growing up as a species, moving out of the hero's journey myth into what is that new story going to look like? How can we make it as ecstatically exciting as the hero's journey was? And I'll tell you a lovely little experience I had this year at that foundation's meeting in Oslo, where Lord Brown, who was head of British Petroleum and is president of this organization, heard me talk about this new story and saying that we've got to make it, about the ecstasy of forming true community. And what happened was that his last line to that whole group of people who really adore him was, "And I loved Elizabeth's concept of ecstatic community," which was a little bit of a twist on the way I used the words. But you see, coming out of his mouth, they could hear it.
Mm.
And that's what's so excited. We have to give these things away, you know, and hope that other people take them up.
Yeah, in answering this question, you're really giving us, illuminating a path that I think for each of us as individuals that we can do in our own lives in our own ways. You know, I know there are a lot of people on this call, and I bet there are a lot of people who want to talk to you. So I just want to ask you, I've just got one more question that I'd like to ask you, and then as far as I'm concerned, we can hear what others want to ask as well.
That's exactly what's on my mind, to get to the audience as quickly as we can.
Traveling the same path. So here's one more question for you, Elizabeth. You know, you're talking about this transformation and your excitement and so on. So I really want to ask you how pessimistic or optimistic are you at this point in time that humanity can make this transformation in time? And why? Why are you pessimistic or optimistic about this?
Yeah. Well, in time is an interesting question because it kind of implies something like the old Phoenix story, that there's some kind of a deadline, that if we do this before that happens, then everything will be okay, right? And
yeah,
it's not like that at all. It is a transformation. It's a gradual process. The faster we build the infrastructure of the new society, the stronger it will be and the better it will last. So it's up to us how well we survive. I have my spiritual view of things is I'm a believer in reincarnation. I believe I and everybody else who's on the planet now is here intentionally. I think we came for this roller coaster ride. And that many of us who are in this kind of group are the ones who really want to guide it as well as we can into a positive future. And I think Earth is a learning place in the cosmos where souls come who don't all have good experiences and good intentions and stuff, but are here to learn something about it. So I don't see us moving into paradise planet. But I do see us growing up as a species. So that's what I'm most interested in, and that's what I'm optimistic about for the simple reason that countless other species before us have done it, that I believe we have made a big investment in being humans, and I don't want to see that experiment fail. So I don't know how many of us will survive. I think I never get too excited about people who are worried about population numbers because I think that's going to be taken care of regardless of whether we pass out condoms or whatever. There's going to be disaster. That's the difficult part, I can tell you. 13 of the largest 20 cities in the world are at sea level. And scientists did not foresee how much moisture the atmosphere could hold. Already 2 years ago, there was 40% more moisture in Earth's atmosphere than normal, what we have called normal in the past. And so we're seeing all those storms and, you know, dumping of ice and snow in New York and Boston and Washington and cyclones colliding in Australia and all of these strange weather things that are happening are due to global warming, even though the people who are sitting in the snowstorm say, huh, everybody was wrong about that, you know. But it's precisely because of the evaporated ice from the poles that these things are happening. Now, if only one-third of the polar ice melts on Earth, the sea level goes up 100 feet. We know that from past geology. This has happened before. So that makes New York a lake, you know. 13 of the largest 20 cities in the world, when the sea level does start to rise because of spongy ice finally starts sliding off in domino sequences from Greenland and Antarctica, it will go fast. It will be a hockey stick curve. And the easiest way to tell people about global warming is you don't need any numbers. Just say to somebody, do you agree that the hotter it gets, the more ice will melt? And they're likely to agree with that. And then if you say, do you agree that the more the ice melts, the hotter it will get because there's less reflective ice to bump off the sunlight? And they'll agree to that. And then you say, that is a positive feedback loop. The more the ice melts, the hotter it gets. The hotter it gets, the more the ice melts. It feeds on itself. It escalates. It turns into what we call a hockey stick curve that goes real slow for a long time and then suddenly leaps up. And that's what's going to happen. The sea level rise will be maybe a few centimeters one day and maybe a few meters the other day. And all those cities will be hit at once. Now, first the sewage backs up, then the airports and the piers are wiped out and there are no supplies coming in. There will be massive refugees. Hundreds of millions of people will be evacuating because we're not relocating the cities uphill as we should be. No sensible business would be living in the risk that we're living now without doing anything about it. So, yes, I see terrible disasters coming, and yes, I see people who are on higher ground and who are learning to live sustainably surviving this.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
that's where we're ending this part of the conversation. I appreciate very much all parts of that. Certainly a lot for all of us to think about. Amit, I'd like to turn this over for others on the call to get into the conversation.
Hi, this is Mish in New York City. And first, I'd just like to thank you so much. Listening to you has been a real eye-opener and has made me look at things very differently. And the person that you were thinking of, was that Arnie Naess, N-A-E-S-S?
Yes. Yes, thank
okay,
you so much.
I thought
N-A-E-S-S. Yes.
Yes, N-A-E-S-S. This might sound like a silly thing to ask you, but living in New York City and being 67 years old as I am, I'm just wondering, when you talk about these coming disasters, is this something I'm going to see in my lifetime?
Well, that's a good question, and a lot of people want to know, you know, when is it going to happen? And what I like to say to them is, you know, we have a hard time predicting weather, but we can tell what the climate is doing because it's a much longer, slower curve, even though it's going fast now mm-hmm. in terms of the massive changes that we've never seen in our lives before. But no one can say exactly when will those ice chunks start sliding in. We can say they will be doing it. We can say the sea levels are going to go up dramatically, but we cannot tell you whether that will be next month or whether it'll be in 2 years or whether it'll be in 10 years or whether it'll be in 20 years.
Yeah.
I really doubt that it will take that long. But yes, New York, look, the Canary Islands on the other side of the Atlantic from you have a huge volcano that when it blows is going to blow out the side directly aimed toward New York, right? And that is going to cause, there's a BBC documentary I've now seen twice on television that ends with the words, it's not a question of whether this is going to happen, it's only a question of when. And that when will remain a question until that tsunami is crossing the Atlantic. It will be the biggest one in all human history.
Yeah.
And it will wash up Manhattan. So what do you do? Lose
well,
sleep every night?
No.
Or recognize that you're an immortal soul and whatever, whenever it happens, you are still going to be in this universe?
Yeah, a friend of mine just said...
Or are you going to move out in New York?
Well, she told me I should build a boat and learn to swim. Okay, thank you for answering my wonderment, and thank you so much for all the knowledge you shared with us today.
Okay, the reason I do remain optimistic is because I see no payoff in pessimism, people. If you, for instance, if you don't believe in life after death and you're very pessimistic and scared of dying, when you do die, you won't know it. And if you were right that there wasn't anything beyond death, I'm not going to know it either. So I can't be proved wrong by being optimistic and saying, oh, yes, life after death is going to be wonderful.
Right. Absolutely.
And you have so much more fun as an optimist than as a pessimist. It doesn't do any good. You just debilitate yourself if you're a pessimist. And if you're an optimist, you'll do something.
Yep, total agreement with you there.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Hello, Elizabeth. Mark Dubois here.
Hi, Mark. How
well,
nice to hear your voice.
It's great to hear you. And again, I am in awe. I'm a little taken aback with your scenario for what our next decade or two face. But the question I have for you is, what's your sense of why science has been so slow, why it has so clung to the old Darwinian perspective and not gotten limbs and your evolutionary biology of, you know, of 1 to 2 billion years, why has that been so missing? And I guess the corollary is, why have the sciences condoned economists subserving all of this sacred planet into economics rather than the recognition of the reverse, and that we're all a part of a much bigger picture? What's your sense of why the profession?
Well, it's of course a very good question, dear Mark.
Be a part of helping the shift occur.
Mark and I last saw each other in Scotland at the New Story Summit up in the Findhorn community this past end of September, early October. But we've known each other for a great many years, and Mark is a very remarkable pioneer, crusader, fighter for Earth's health, and especially for saving rivers and things. Did we meet in Moscow?
Yes, indeed.
Yep. That's what I thought. Mark was running around Moscow in midwinter in a short sleeved shirt. Amazing, all the Russians. And we actually went out to Yevtushenko's dacha, little summer place outside the city. Yevtushenko is a very famous poet in Russia. And we had an amazing evening with him, reading him his poems in English, which he had never heard out loud in English. They had just the complete works of Yevtushenko had just been published in London. So Mark and I go way back. That was in the late 80s, I think. And okay, to your question, dear Mark. Science has been funded. First, when I was a graduate student in the 50s and 60s, by the military-industrial complex, and it is still being funded. It sort of shifted from the military to the industry part of that military-industrial complex that's so interwoven. And, of course, that whole complex is rooted in the world economy that's based on the Darwinian theory. So that economy, that's the hero's journey economy, that's the youthful economy, that's the competitive economy, and it doesn't want to be proven wrong. It doesn't want to move into its mature phase, and so the money keeps going to preserving that worldview. That's a simple answer.
That's great. You know, actually, Mark, while I have you on the line as well, I think it's wonderful that the two of you guys already have an existing connection. And I know we had you on the Awaken Call as a guest last year. And, this is something I wanted to actually share with both of you and maybe get your both of your perspectives on that. You know, one of the things that's one field that's been growing pretty quickly is the field of biomimicry. And for those of you on the call that are not familiar, biomimicry is basically an approach to, innovation that finds solutions to different human challenges by trying to emulate nature. And, there was an article not too long ago in the Associated Press by this writer, Greg Bluestein, who titled, Scientists Are Taking Cues from Nature. You know, and in there he was interviewing a number of folks, and, one of the individuals stated, if you think of organisms as products, all the bad ones have been recalled. And those of that have survived have evolved over millions of years. And ironically, at the end of the article, it said that every organism is designed to solve a problem. And so I'm just curious, when looking at that from whether it's a biologist perspective or from a nature perspective, I guess, what would you say we're designed to solve?
That's a nice question. I like that one. It's one I've never been asked before, and I do like it. By the way, biomimicry was introduced by Janine Benyus with the book of that name. Actually, the word biomimicry has long existed in the field of biology, but was applied to those organisms that made themselves look like a different species for some reason of protection. Let's say a big moth that looks like an owl because the spots look like owl eyes and therefore it doesn't get eaten by things. But in my Earth Dance book, I had a whole chapter devoted to how all of our technology has always copied nature. Whether we learn to weave like spiders or fly like birds or tunnel like moles or try to copy our brains in computers and stuff like that, there's nothing else to be inspired by as a species other than, you know, the other species of our planet. So we've always done biomimicry in that sense. But we haven't really looked at how nature does it. We've just said, oh, birds can fly. Let's us figure out how to fly, and we'll do it better than nature. And now Janine came in and said, no, we need to see how nature does it, and we need to copy more precisely what nature has learned about making clean, green things. We live in this technological economy where we heat, beat, and treat stuff that we've extracted from the earth, and we waste 94%, I think, or 96% of what we dig out of the earth just to make the metals and things that we're going to put into our technology. And a few years after we create the technology, we toss it in a landfill, which is almost 100% waste. And we have to learn how to recycle everything the way nature does and not to make these toxics and stuff. So Is the point? I think one of the points of humanity is that we have the kind of mind that can pretend we're apart from nature and superior to it. And then we can learn that that is a losing tack and still save ourselves. So that's one story I have about us. We had this ability to pretend we were different and superior to the whole game in this universe, and now we're learning that, whoops, we'd better backtrack a little and use these amazing minds that we do have to fit ourselves into this system. Now, we have brought into the system really beautiful music, really beautiful art, dance, not that other species haven't done some of that, but we another thing that humans do differently from other species is that we've learned to communicate through complex languages. And while other species and our own selves only commune, they do this direct transmission of information to each other. And we don't even give them credit for doing that because Western science doesn't even acknowledge that nature is intelligent to start with, right? And it doesn't realize that our cells couldn't possibly run themselves as each of them as complex as a huge human city with 1,000 banks and 30,000 recycling centers and all that. If it didn't commune, if your body, if each of your cells didn't know its place in the body on that communion level. So I distinguish between communion and communication, and communication is something, language, that humans brought in a more complex way than species such as whales and dolphins that do it to a certain extent, and birds and lots of other species that do it to a certain extent. But again, we're trying out new things that haven't been done before. And my basic law of the universe, by the way, which I see as a self-organizing, self-creating universe that's all conscious, all intelligent, is anything that can happen will happen. I think that's the only principle of nature. I don't believe in laws of nature. I believe in observing regularities, but I don't see a lawgiver. So in the course of self-organizing, certain regularities have happened because they worked well and they continue. And in a universe that in which anything that can happen will happen, humans are some of the most far-out experimenters, probably the world has ever known, or the universe has ever known, perhaps. So maybe that's our claim to fame, is that we can push the boundaries further than other species and still recover from our transgressions. How's that?
That's great, Mark.
Well,
I was going to ask you, maybe try to shed some thoughts on that as well.
You know, the short answer I would offer is that, you know, Elizabeth talked about how many things are going on in parallel to the old paradigm. There's this new emergent everywhere. And I would only offer that my sense is what's invisible to most of us, it's definitely invisible to the media, but there's this collective emergence and evolution that Elizabeth so beautifully touched on. And my sense is that we humans are in the very process of slowly learning how to connect the genius of half of our brain to our hearts and our guts and the other half of our brain that knows we are connected to everything. And that evolutionary maturity and learning that it is, rather than that genius being so disconnected, that we're in the time of this privilege of learning how to put those in sync, so that we've become the depth and beauty that Elizabeth referred to in terms of what's been going on with this evolutionary journey, becoming more beauty, grace, elegance, and dancing and living in resonance and in a harmonic with a greater universe that we've had our tuning cut out to for so long.
Oh, Mark, I knew I needed you. I love you so much. He's so right, and I don't know how I managed to forget that. So thank you for the reminder that the really, really wonderful task of humans is to bring cosmic love all the way down to our toes, to ground it, not just intellectually and not even just down to the heart level, but all the way down to our toes, to bring cosmic love to Earth fully embodied, fully embodied. You know, they say that angels are lined up for human bodies, and there's a wonderful book by Byron Katie's husband called Meetings with the Archangel. And the protagonist in this book is talking to the archangel after he's written the book against angels, and this big angel shows up in his yard. And they have this long conversation throughout the book. And near the end of it, the angel says, "Don't look to us angels for compassion. We can't even feel passion. You have to have a physical body to vibrate passion. And so you are here to bring compassion into the world through these physical bodies." So that's, again, the same kind of story. And this is really beautiful mission for humans, don't you think?
I agree. I mean, you know, it's interesting. You know, one of the things you were just saying too, Mark, was this idea of this maturity that we have to gain. And is there a way to speed that up? Is there a way to learn quickly, or does it end up just having to take its course? And then will it be soon enough? I don't know the answer to that.
Oh, it's speeding up. It's speeding up fast now.
It's,
you know, like other species, there's nothing like a good crisis to kick species into action. And when you know things are this bad, man, you really need love to get you through.
Absolutely.
So let's ground that cosmic love.
I would just add, Elizabeth, too, I really find myself sensing that, I don't know if we're 5 weeks, 5 months, or 5 years before the equivalent of the Berlin Wall falling, before apartheid ended, before the civil rights movement had a name, before the first Earth Day. Nobody could predict any of those things a month beforehand. They looked purely impossible. The old paradigm had such a grip. And my sense is that the dissonance, our hearts knows this is absurd. And so to me, we are so close to the living in fear, knowing that I'm going to change you instead of doing my inner work. I mean, you know, Service Space has been pioneering this inner work. And it's where the time to me where we get to transcend living in fear, scarcity, and separation, and we get to live in that which you have been so elegantly laying out, part of our evolutionary journey, and living in this collaborative, cooperative beauty and grace and elegance. So thanks for pioneering it.
Yeah, you know, there's another, we call them black swans, right, when you can't predict them and suddenly it's there on your screen because nobody knew that there were anything but white swans until somebody finally saw a black one. And so Matt Taibbi has written that wonderful book about black swans. And the newest one to me is the finance minister of Greece. You know, as a Greek citizen, it's fascinating to me because I've been following Yanis Varoufakis for the past 2 years as an amazing person. And what he's role modeling now is a whole new kind of politician, a politician who's totally transparent, who doesn't wear the clothes he's supposed to wear as a politician, and who just holds his ground and is so logical that no one can argue him down. And it's just causing such a flurry in the world for him to say, look, it's crazy to keep extending money to people, you know, and getting them deeper and deeper into debt, and lending them more money isn't going to get them out of debt. And even though things are so deep into this debt system, this credit system now, that he's had to make some compromises, he is, you know, rolling back austerity in Greece as the first person who's been able to start that process going. And he doesn't want to save just Greece. He wants to save the whole European Union. And he's exposing the whole neoliberal project that in the U.S. was called the neoconservative project, the Reagan-Thatcher economics that privatized the world in this juvenile mode of fierce competition and set up these huge economic inequities. And here's somebody who just bops onto the political scene and says, the emperor doesn't wear any clothes, you know.
That's great. So you know, we
almost as good as the Berlin Wall.
Yeah. We,
if not better.
We had one of our callers wrote into us and said, you know, what, and it seems somewhat related here, what gentle methods could be used to raise the consciousness, you know, whether it's ecological mm-hmm. consciousness, you know, and this individual, name is Virginia Levin, lives in a retirement community of 1,000-plus residents. And so, you know, she asked, what gentle methods could be used to raise ecological consciousness of the 1,000-plus residents in my village? Our powers that be do much to encourage this area, but apathy is rampant.
Yes. Well, the gentle ways are to tell new stories and to make sure, as I said, that our new stories really fire people up with the ecstasy of forming true community and practicing that community on the most local level, in your retirement home, wherever you are, in your community, the spirit of Service Space, doing nice things for people, random acts of kindness, gifting, not always looking for a return, you know. It's living the future as if it is already here, the one you want. That's the gentle way, because you can't change other people. You can only change yourself, but you have to become an attractor. You have to become a role model. You know, most parents figure out sooner or later that you can't puff on a cigarette and tell your kids not to smoke, that you have to role model the things that you're trying to teach. And so if you're ethical, if you're transparent, if you're kind, if you're loving, other people will benefit from that and get a little more loving and kind themselves. It is gentle in that sense. And sometimes we have to be fierce and stand up and say, no, you can't do this to me and my children and my grandchildren anymore. You know, it takes all kinds. And that's why I like to say, just however you want to change the world, make sure it's a way that makes your heart sing. That it has to be something that you're positively passionate about. You waste your time pointing fingers at all the people doing things wrong. You waste your time trying to tear things down. It only makes sense to role model and to build that butterfly.
So well put. Mark, thank you very much for your questions and also for sharing your input. I want to go to our next caller who seems to embody exactly what you just said. Elizabeth, one moment. We'll go to our next caller.
Elizabeth, this is Nipun. So nice to hear your voice and your stories.
You were listening in. How sweet.
How could I not? How could I not? I even had a question. I think you've alluded to this in some of your books in brief and certainly in person, but I was wondering if you could share a little bit about, some spiritual experience or some experiential insight that you've had, because a lot of this I know from having known you, having had the pleasure of knowing you, a lot of this really comes from a very deep place within you, and your convictions are strengthened by those kinds of experiences. So I was wondering if you could share if you had experiences early on that sort of deepened your faith, because it doesn't just seem to be an intellectual, yeah, this is the thing I want to do. It's coming from a much deeper place. So I was wondering if you could share an experience that that got you going on this track and in such a way that it's like you've never left that value system.
Well, it's an interesting question. Part of me goes back to that Socratic story that says, I didn't see the path ahead. I didn't know where I was going, but I always knew when I was off my path. And I think it's important for us all to cultivate our, pardon the expression, shit detectors. And also our I'm off course detectors. When you don't feel right about doing something, one indigenous lady once said, try for a while living with saying yes only to things that you can be 100% behind as a yes. If you have any doubts or if you have any qualms about something you're asked to do or whatever, say no. Try to live, on the positive side of things. Now, I have had the odd experience of seeing that my world was not what I was taught it was in science. Probably the most dramatic was one time when I very much wanted to buy a window fan that had been in a shop before I'd gone away and gone to a conference on consciousness called The Magic Reality. And when I went back to the little store to get it, because there was a big heat wave, it wasn't there. And to make a long story short, I was stubbornly glued in place where I had seen that window fan only a week before, refusing to believe that it wasn't there and that two employees told me it wasn't there. And suddenly it materialized. And it didn't fade in. It was just there from one split second to the next. And I went over and touched it. It was solid. It still had the same tag I remembered on it saying, 4 speeds, only 3 work, no refund. It was one of those outlet shops. And I picked it up and took it to the cash register, and the woman turned pale and said, where did you get that? Because it was a small enough shop. Everyone knew by now what I was looking for and what wasn't there. And I said, it was back there. Can I buy it? And what could she do? But check me out. And all 4 speeds work. Things like
how,
that.
How did you process that, at that time?
Denial for a while. I must have made that whole story up, right? And then remembering the employees that were witnesses and all that stuff. That's one of those situations where you say, wait a minute, that cannot have happened. But it did happen. No, it couldn't have. Yes, it did. And then I had a number of others that were like that, slightly less dramatic. One involved materializing an elk in the forest that I'd really wanted to see, who hadn't been there before.
So
I did a lot of... I did a lot of work with indigenous people, and I saw them do ceremonies where very magical things to the rest of us magical happened. And one of my friends is David Abram, you know, Spell of the Sensuous, and his experiences. And I remember sitting with David long ago saying, David, you're a sleight of hand magician. You know what magic is. Where do you draw the line in nature between magic and reality? And he just looked at me and said, Elizabeth, there is no such line. Nature is profoundly magical. And it's that, the experiences that added up to knowing that Jane Roberts' Seth, for those of you who know the Seth book, was right. We create our reality. What we focus on is what we get. If we focus on fear, we're going to get scary situations. The universe is obliging that way. And our humanity has, out of massive fear, created very scary situations now. The other day, my son was talking about how the universe is so in balance that we have to expect just as much bad as good. And I say, I choose to live my life in the most positive way to redress the balance a bit, because I think the negative has gotten the upper hand here. So I don't have to balance my negative and positive in my own life if I want to be the positive force that helps to rebalance the larger scene.
Beautiful, beautiful.
I don't know if I answered your question, Nipun.
No, sure. And I think that's sort of the takeaway is that we, you know, our minds matter most. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Mind matters. Mind matters the whole world. And that's, you know, that again is what gives me optimism. I know that if I hang out with positive people, if I behave positively myself, if I talk in this kind of a group rather than with the you know, CEOs and board members of the big multinationals, which can be very challenging, I feel the energy in this kind of a group, the energy that's the energy of the future world we want.
That's great. Thank you, Nipun. Appreciate the question. I wanted to.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for being here with us. Can't wait to see you again.
Yeah, likewise.
In person.
Appreciate that. I'm going to turn it over to Arye really quickly. I know he has a nice little zinger for us, and then we will close out the call.
Elizabeth, you know, amazing conversation. Hey, I want to go back to the early part of the story, your story that you were telling about yourself as a rule breaker who would have these impulses to do things in a different way. As a girl who didn't want to be confined to art and wanted to go to science, or as a young woman who ran off with Henry Miller to Greece or whatever, that you, there was something that you were following. And I want to ask you, as a pastist, looking back over the past, from your perspective today, where did those impulses come from?
I think they're available to all of us. We sometimes call them intuition. By the way, in being a rule breaker, sometimes I got fired, you know, from jobs and stuff, and then had to scrabble to raise my children when I was out on the street from work. So it wasn't always easy, but something always told me that we're in the, you know, I'm thinking of Ed Mitchell, the astronaut, who on his moonshot trip had this epiphany of realizing that he was held in the arms of the universe and could not be lost, and lost all his fear of getting back into that tiny little tin can or having to ride all the way back to Earth after the last mission had failed or had gotten into such serious trouble. Apollo 13 had gotten into such bad trouble. And it's that feeling that we are permanently a part of this great eternal now. You know, none of us has any experience outside of now. The whole cosmos is all now. So it's even more complex than when you stretch it out on timelines. And I have this profound sense that we're here intentionally, we're immortals, we're part of a universe that is even much more fascinating than we dream of as humans, and that's what keeps me going.
So Elizabeth, thank you so much. It's been an absolutely incredible call. And I think, you know, I think Devin actually had just a beautiful sentiment there. And I think,
yes,
you know, if anything
wonderful
that we're going to take away is, you know, bringing down that cosmic love all the way down to our feet. And
that's right. And have a good time. You were meant to have fun on this planet, even if things are as bad as they are. It doesn't matter, you see. We are immortals. And it's a challenge. And it's all here for us to learn from. And the learning is love. Whatever the question, the answer is love. I love that song.
Well, wonderful. Well, I think the way we'd like to sign off the call is if we could just invite everyone to hold a collective minute of silence in gratitude. And then after the silence, I'll open up the lines and maybe we can share that gratitude out loud and do a collective thank you to Elizabeth. And so if we can, just a moment of silence, please. Thank you. And if we can, on the count of three, just do a nice collective thank you to Elizabeth, that'd be wonderful. I'm just going to take everyone here off of mute. One, two, and three.
Thank you.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you so much.
On my feet.
Namaste.
Thank you all.
Oh, namaste to all of you.
Thank you all.